20th century theologian Karl Rahner noted, "The Christian of the future will be a mystic, or he will not exist at all." Now that's something to think about. From Wyoming Catholic College, this is the After Dinner Scholar, our weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. In his new book, An Introduction to Christian Mysticism, Recovering the Wildness of Spiritual Life, Wyoming Catholic College professor Dr. Jason Baxter notes that today mysticism makes us a little more than nervous. It seems to have New Age and Eastern connotations. Nonetheless, he notes, quote, "In the pre-modern age, that is, what is now called late antiquity and the Middle Ages, everything you could say before AD 1500, mysticism wasn't some bizarre, exotic, cultish, or unusual phenomenon like it has become, stored on bookshelves dealing with paranormal occurrences. Rather, it was seen as the lifeblood of prayer and adoration of God in the soul." Then he goes on, "Ignoring it would be like selling a precious family heirloom at an estate sale because you didn't know what it was." I asked Dr. Baxter to begin by telling us what this heirloom is. What is mysticism?
The cloud of unknowing, a 14th century English translation and reworking for a popular audience of some ancient mystical text, begins by talking about that very thing. And it says, I'm going to paraphrase, but something to the effect of mysticism is the realization of the desire for me to know God in his unclothed splendor in the very depths of my being.
Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. It's
You wrote a book about unpacking it.
Yeah, exactly. I think the interesting thing is that mysticism is not necessarily connected with visions or stigmatist or signs or wonders or marvels. But rather, it's a kind of, I mean, we could call it in scare quotes, an intellectual encounter with God, even though that has to be qualified almost immediately, suggesting it's more than just sort of knowing having correct opinions or correct, spiritual facts. In the mystical tradition, it's very strange, but says that there's a faculty which is higher than intellect. Some call it love, some call it the heart, some call it this inner capacity to engage in unitive participation, what they would call intelligentsia or intellectus, or in Greek, nous. But there's something which is at, some say, at the apex of the mind. Imagine the mind as a sort of triangle. And as you climb to the top, at the very topmost point, there is a non-rational, non-discursive faculty which can know by grasping in immediacy, that is, without any mediation. And that's essentially what mysticism is. Or I just like to say, quoting from the Psalms, using a medieval interpretation of the Psalms, deep calls to deep. And there are medieval Cistercians who read that as something like, from the depth of God is a calling which I respond to in the depth of myself.
How did you become so interested in mysticism that you wrote a book about it?
I think I started getting into it because I teach the comedy, Dante's comedy, at Wyoming Catholic College a lot. And the third of those parts, Paradiso, where Dante's vision to heaven is very difficult, as everyone knows. And in order to kind of prep my students for it, I would just give a brief introductory lecture to medieval thoughts on the ineffability of God. That is, why, or as Paul says, the eretorikos, that which you can't use language to fully capture. And why is that the case? What did these medieval mystics know? What did they teach? And as I started to explain this to the students, two things happened. One, I realized that this so-called mysticism wasn't an isolated phenomenon by a couple of peripheral figures in the Middle Ages, but rather it was something like the lifeblood of prayer before the modern age. And I kept being surprised to find it everywhere. It's in Bonaventure. It's in Aquinas. It's in writers who are using an old form of German and an old form of Dutch. And it's in French and it's in Italian and it's in Greek. And it's just all these different sort of linguistic traditions of Europe have these mystical flowerings, which Bernard McGinn has written extensively about in his 8-volume and ongoing history of these sort of things. Anyway, so I discovered that it was ubiquitous, that it wasn't a strange fringe phenomenon like it is for us. I mean, you walk into a bookstore now and say, I'm interested in your books on mysticism, and they take you to the UFO section, right? You're crazy, or you're looking for crystals or, you know, New Age spirituality. That's where you get taken if now. But at one point, this was a vital practice in the church and carefully cultivated by contemplatives. So I realized that it was something very important which we'd forgotten. And that was confirmed by my second discovery, that my students all thought I was teaching heresy. They started furrowing their brows at me and saying, what are you talking about? That doesn't sound like anything that we've heard before. And I just said, this is just the first 12 questions of Thomas's Summa. But it was this extraordinary moment in which what was, I almost want to say, commonplace before 1300, and you would have heard preached to you in your own language from the pulpit, now seems like a paranormal New Age phenomenon to us. That seemed to me was crying out for a rescue.
Now, in the book, you outline 4 schools of mysticism. You talk about the Augustinian, the Via Negativa, the Way of the Desert Fathers, and Lectio Divina. Tell us something about each one and what they add to our understanding.
Yeah, so one of the major points I want to make in the book is that you can't skip rungs on the ladder to get to the highest level of mysticism. And I think that would be our proclivity in our modern culture to stick your spiritual life in the microwave and speed it up, right? I mean, the image that always goes through my mind is the woman speeding to her yoga class in her Toyota Prius and cutting people off and flipping them off so that she can go there and be enlightened, right? You can skip the process of being kind to your neighbors and being a decent human being if you're deep enough. The fascinating phenomenon is when you're reading these medieval treatises is about how 85% of the stuff in there isn't what we would call the good stuff, where we talk about the encounter with God, that mystical encounter in prayer. Interestingly enough, Lewis is a lot like this too. He's very interested in mysticism, but almost every time he talks about it in his writing, he's always warning people off it. I think for very similar reasons, because he believes that first you need to rise in the morning and say your prayers to God and love your spouse and take care of your children and look for opportunities to do charitable deeds and pray your prayers at a regular hour as sort of, you know, progress in the perfection of the spiritual life before we can learn about these kind of, you know, kind of graduate school levels of the spiritual life. Anyway, with that in mind, thinking about mysticism as a school, as what philosopher Pierre Hadot called a way of life. It's discipleship. And mysticism, the good stuff of the mysticism, this deep encounter with God and his depth from my depth, is way, way down the road. And so these different sort of schools have different approaches of how it's best to prepare. So for example, if you're one of the early desert fathers, like an Evagrius, the emphasis is on controlling what I love to call your spiritual fidgetiness, your tendency to lust or to anxiety or to worry about international politics or economies or imminent collapses or imminent oppressive regimes or whatever. So Evagrius and company thought that basically the desert was essential. You had to move out to a quiet space and you had to push out all of these things in order to regain a sense of tranquility. And when you would regain this sense of tranquility, then you could begin worrying about these sort of deeper forms of prayer, one of which is the very mysterious, very interesting, but revived by Pope Francis, idea of theoria physicae, or natural contemplation, allowing the world's beauty. Jim and I are here and looking out our window at the snow in Wyoming, right? Allowing the world's beauty to become your prayer in a way, in which your own tendency to the small petitionary prayers become sort of enlarged by the world's beauty, as if the world were groaning and longing, as Paul says in Romans, to have you give a voice to it. So there's that's practiced in the desert, the ancient desert of 4th and 5th century. With Augustine, my chapter on Augustine is really all about spiritual infancy. It's all about the paradox that I have to use my powers as an adult human, my rationality, my virtue, my self-discipline, in order to get back to this inner spiritual phase of being an infant. And it doesn't mean childish, but it does mean childlike. And to return to that, Augustine uses this extraordinary image of an infant nursing. A close relationship to God is like the infant nursing from its mother's breast. It's a really provocative image. But to return to that sort of spiritual stage, and the sort of via negativa, principally represented by, we could say, Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, a 5th and 6th century Byzantine theologian who's influenced by heavy-duty, heavy-lifting Platonic philosophy. And he has this idea of divine naming. That is, as he says, because God is the cause of being, he must be above being, which means any attribute, that is, anytime you say it is something, any predicate nominative or predicative adjective, is going to be limited with respect to our knowledge of God. In fact, infinitely limited. So it's better for us to say what God is not, so that we can safeguard his infinite majesty from the presumption of the intellect to think that we know who he is.
You know, as I was reading your book, it occurred to me that I don't know that they appeal to one person or another, but they speak to the spiritual or to the needs of one person or another. I've known people who say they don't, but they kind of believe in salvation through theology. Well, they need a good dose of, it seems to me, of the via negativa.
I love it.
Lazy people like me need Evagrius and the spiritual athletes of the desert. Does that kind of make sense?
I love it. I think that's great. I said in the beginning that my goal was to almost, you know, you walk into some of these coffee shops, right, and a local photographer has hung up all of his portraits of people all across the room. And they're sort of generally related, even though they're just sort of unique portraits. That's how I kind of felt what I was doing in this book. I was taking portraits. I was digging through the treasure trove of the church, which reminds me of my favorite Italian joke. There's an Italian comedian who says, there are more uncatalogued treasures in the basements of Italian museums than there are in the rest of the world on display combined. Right? I feel like that's a good image for the traditional spiritual treasury of the church. There are all these things down there still in boxes, uncatalogued. And come to find out, they're Da Vinci sketches, right? Or early Raphaels. I mean, they're priceless objects which couldn't even be sold on the market, right? Analogously to that, I think in our past, there are all these rich kind of spiritual treasures. And so I wanted to go down there to the basement, rummage around a little bit, and drag some things back out, things which scholars know and love. But something, try to make it accessible for people who are good people, who are striving on a daily basis, but need to be awakened from a kind of spiritual somnolence, which is just inherent in our age.
Well, that answers my last question, is what you're hoping and praying for from the book.
And, I'm kind of terrified of this book. And I think every author obviously wants his book to be successful, wants people to read it, wants, you know, to do cool podcasts with cool people. I think every author obviously wants that. But on the other hand, I've been kind of terrified about talking about it because I don't feel I know what I'm talking about, which I suppose is appropriate to the subject. I think with things which are sort of closer to my academic specialization, medieval literature, Dante, Platonism, that kind of stuff, I feel confident. I feel I can say something. In this case, I feel that it's hard to say something. Or maybe the whole point is just to go up to the limit of what can be said and then fall silent and gesture beyond it. And so I guess if people follow the gesture, follow the point, then it will have been a successful book.
Nicholas of Cusa, who lived in the 15th century, wrote, quote, God wills to be sought and wills to give to seekers the light without which they are unable to seek God. God wills to be sought, and God also wills to be apprehended. For it is God's will to uncover and to disclose God's self to those who seek. Close quote. Let me enthusiastically recommend Dr. Baxter's book, An Introduction to Christian Mysticism, and also the distance learning course Dr. Baxter taught during Lent 2020, Into the Lenten Desert. That distance learning class is available on our college website, wyomingcatholic.edu. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.